Support for The Front Porch comes from WVCarFinder.com, matching West Virginia cars to West Virginians who want to buy them. It's a service of the Charleston Gazette-Mail. More at WVCarFinder.com. Hi, I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and you're on The Front Porch. I'm joined, as always, by Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
And we have a special guest. We have Rick's daughter, Sarah Jarvis, and Sarah is a psychologist. You're going to give us the dirt on Rick Wilson, the real story behind your father, right?
As much as I can, I am within striking distance, though, so I got to be mindful of that as well.
She's a black belt, too.
That could be interesting. Have you guys ever fought each other?
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
Who wins?
He's much faster than what I am, so it's my job to try to block, but I think I'm catching up at times.
And not yet having to deal with black belt children, but maybe someday, is Lori Lynn. Lori Lynn is a columnist and also a lawyer, and we're reaching her at her house here in Charleston to the magic of radio. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
And today we're going to talk about the failure of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. At least we think it's dead for the session this year in West Virginia. We're going to talk about some bills that would deal with felons. Do they deserve a second chance? Will second chance bills get through this legislature? And what about increasing the penalties for people who are involved in drug crimes? But let's lead off with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The bill, which passed the House pretty handily, went over to the West Virginia Senate, where it was amended to supposedly make it clearer that it would not be able to interfere with or override some local municipalities which have some anti-discrimination laws, supposedly helping people who are gay, lesbian, and transgender. And the people who want the bill, supported the bill originally, did not like this amendment. And so basically the whole bill failed spectacularly in the Senate. It's unclear whether there'll be an effort to bring it back. So let's start with you, Rick. What do you think the failure of this bill means?
You know, if it was just about religious freedom, it's interesting that the groups turned against the amendment at that point. I think that's when they sort of showed their hand. It's a really good question. This is one I did not see coming. I think when the amendments were proposed in committee, I think some people really looked deep inside themselves and called it like they saw it, even though it might not have been popular with some people in their own party.
I guess I'm a little bit surprised by the surprise. This was something that I kind of always imagined would run into some trouble in the Senate. It was a House-originated bill, and that seemed to be where the big push was coming from. The Senate, obviously, is just a much more moderate body. They're very liberal senators and very conservative senators, but as a whole, the Senate tends to be more moderate, and of course it's very closely divided. So to me, it looked like something that was always going to be a tough sell in the Senate. So I guess I'm not quite as shocked. I guess the way it went down was fairly dramatic with, you know, the amendment and Mitch Carmichael getting very emotional on the Senate floor and kind of the lopsided vote in the end, but I guess I'm a little less surprised than Rick is.
So, yeah, Senator Mitch Carmichael, the majority leader, Republican from Jackson County, had a really tearful, I think you could say, emotional speech.
And I don't want us to go down this path. I just don't. I work hard for jobs and opportunity. For those reasons, I would ask that we adopt this amendment, and then we can vote for this bill, allow it not to be used for discriminatory purposes, to value the religious freedom and protection that we hold so dear, and to recognize the human dignity and goodness of people that are different than us.
I think it was a moment of conscience. It's one thing to support freedom of religion, which the First Amendment already does a pretty good job of. It's another to use the law to provide a sort of a shield for discrimination. And I think he looked in his heart, and that's what was there. So I give him credit for that.
Yeah, one of the arguments is that, this bill in West Virginia has already been passed in all these other states, similar versions of it, and they don't seem to have suffered any ill effects. Lori, as a lawyer, do you think that the West Virginia bill was similar to these other bills? Or are we making too much out of its the effect it's going to have?
Yeah, I mean, everybody is making too much of it. Both sides, I would say. And, you know, we have a federal RFRA. So if the prospect of RFRA was going to drive you away from the state, you know, you'd have to move a lot farther than Ohio, because there's a federal one that was proposed by Chuck Schumer in the 90s and signed by Bill Clinton. This is not legislation that I think we really needed, but it also, I don't think, was going to usher in an era of hate the way that people seem to be talking about it. I mean, like you said, 21 other states have them, including, you know, states like Pennsylvania. I think Connecticut has one. Those are not places that we think of as really hateful places. And they're also not being used, at least used successfully, to discriminate against gay people. I mean, that there's the possibility that they could be, but they certainly aren't in any widespread way. I mean, I understand why people were upset about it and up in arms about it. One point I would make as far as the, you know, the reaction to it is, there was a similar fight over the same issue back in this past summer in Indiana. I think that was in July, and that got so much attention. It sort of took over the national conversation for several days, you know, like a week. We didn't really get that here, and I think that's just kind of an interesting lesson. I mean, it was a big deal, you know, in the state, but there wasn't the nationwide attention, which, you know, obviously was because there's a lot more going on. There's this crazy presidential race. We're deep into the campaign season, but it really was the same fight.
Okay, I'm going to go random here a little bit. Lori, at one point we talked about doing a segment on the anti-discrimination arguments in Lewisburg. Do you recall that?
Yes, yes.
We never quite got around to it.
Mm-hmm, the bathroom fight.
The bathroom thing. And I think one of the most bizarre things was a major talking point people did was, if you pass this kind of legislation, then there would be like human wave transgender assaults in bathrooms and things. And in the face of zero evidence at all. And, you know, I just like to say, it's probably as likely or more likely that transgender people would train ferrets to swim through the pipes and attack God-fearing people. You know, I mean, they're both on about the same par in terms of likelihood.
But why can't common sense take over here? Why are we really having a deluge of lawsuits and instances like this? Or is this just one of those symbolic bills? But let's switch topics a little bit, but a related topic. Uber. The House and the Senate have approved a bill that would legalize the ride-sharing service, Uber, and other ride-sharing services in West Virginia. Last year, this bill got tripped up because it had anti-discrimination inside the bill, and the Senate wanted that in the bill, and the House didn't. Lori, what's different this time? What's happened?
Well, you're right. It got tripped up last year, and the vote on Uber turned into a vote on whether we should change the anti-discrimination laws, essentially for all taxi cab companies. They tried to put the same amendment in this time in the House. I think last year it just sort of took everyone by surprise. This amendment just kind of got stuck on there. It sounded innocuous, and then all of a sudden people realized. I think this year the House, in particular, and the committee chairman and the members in general have gotten a little bit more savvy about what's going on with some of these amendments, and that was voted down. So then when they went to vote on the Uber bill, it was just a clean, regular Uber bill, and the only issues were, you know, background checks and insurance and things that are actually germane to Uber, and it didn't kind of end up being this fraught LGBT thing the way it was last year, and it passed, if not unanimously, then close to unanimously. I think it's a positive thing that it was just about Uber and it didn't turn into this kind of larger fight. And it's interesting to me, in a way, Uber made a real push here. I mean, they hired a lobbyist. They really want to be here. You know, I think it's a great service. Probably not a whole lot of people here have used it. Certainly, you know, you have had to go to somewhere else to use it. But it's a great, great thing. It kind of removes all of the hassles traditionally of using a cab, the having to hail one, paying in cash. You know, everything is on your smartphone. It really is a wonderful, wonderful way of using technology to improve people's lives. Like you said, Scott, not only for the riders, but for people who are actually able to make extra income from it. So, you know, I think it's great. Welcome, Uber. We are excited to have you here.
You know, I find it interesting. In West Virginia, there's always this extra element to these sort of debates, which is people are going to make horrible fun of us if we don't pass it. And we don't want to be seen as, quote unquote, backwards. You know, there have been Uber debates all over the country, fought on all sorts of different levels about worker fairness and how much people are getting paid and all sorts of different issues. I just find it fascinating. In West Virginia, this was totally played as if we don't pass the Uber bill, we will be seen as this backwards place.
Boy, that would be terrible, wouldn't it, guys?
Okay, fair enough. I was hoping that we could also speak about, Rick, something that you wrote about. There are several different bills dealing with the fact that the drug abuse epidemic in West Virginia is leading to a situation where people are getting these felony records. And because of these felony records, it's making it difficult for them to find employment and to have a driver's license and all those things you need to function. In your op-ed, Rick, what was the number of people? 150,000?
Well, there's several different bills floating around. I think the one you're referring to now is the Second Chance to Drive bill, basically, which Governor Tomlin introduced. And what it would do, about 55,000 people every year in the state lose their driver's licenses, not for DUIs or moving violations, but because of fines and other costs which they can't pay. Then if you can't drive, you can't work. And if you can't work, you don't get paid. And if you don't get paid, you can't pay your fines. And so what the bill would do is create a provisional driver's license program where people within it would pay about $50 a month, you know, to bear their fines down and also be able to work. And it cleared the Senate by pretty much unanimously. And it just last night it cleared up the House Committee on Roads and Transportation. It's going to the Judiciary next. It's one that I think makes a lot of sense all the way around. Now, there's another one that you're talking about, too. It's a little bit different.
We did a show on this, the Second Chance Employment Bill,
right,
which would allow people to petition nonviolent offenders to be able to petition to have their felony records expunged. Is that right? So that they would be able to hopefully find work.
Yeah, and it would only be after 5 years, and it wouldn't be a guaranteed thing. It would have to be a nonviolent, non-sexual offense, and they'd have to go to court to do it. And the people, including the people who were the victims of the crime, would have a vote. I mean, it's not an automatic pass by any means. It's a pretty rigorous bill. But
that's stuck. It sounds like Speaker Tim Armstead does not agree with this bill. And on the other hand, you wrote about that there are other bills, mandatory minimum bills, that would increase the penalties on people that deal drugs.
Aimed at people who engage in the drug trade. And it would, again, it would bring back pretty stiff mandatory minimums, which is something there's been a movement against around the country.
Explain to me, I'll push back. Explain to me why drug dealers, someone who's dealt drugs and sold drugs to other people, why should we not be increasing the penalties on that?
Well, they can get pretty stiff penalties as things are now. This would just not take away the automatic thing, leave some room for the discretion of judges to look at the situation, the person. And then, you know, for the last 30 years in this country, there's been a boom in mass incarceration and imprisoning people, and it's very expensive. It soaks up other money. People usually don't come out of prisons a whole lot happier and more well-adjusted than they were before. It creates a whole population that's sort of disenfranchised and has trouble with work, marriage, assets, and everything else. So there's been a trend around the country and in West Virginia to try to move away from that, to protect public safety, absolutely, but consistent with that to do more community-based corrections and things like that. So I think mandatory minimums are a real blunt instrument, and it's really expensive. Here's an example. Lori, I don't know how you feel about this, but there was this puppy dogs and kittens bill that would create a mental health task force for kids that really would not have cost any money. I think DHHR insisted on putting like a $50,000 or $60,000 fiscal note on it. And I think it died because they didn't want to run anything with a fiscal note. Here, on the other hand, like, we'll pay any price, bear any burden to lock people up. You know, I'm not sure you can have it both ways.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get a whole lot of pushback from me on, you know, being tough on dealers. I think, you know, obviously there's a difference between, you know, just use and possession. You know, when you get into dealing, I think it's kind of a little harder to make the case that we should be, you know, not tough on those people. The point, though, about the mandatory nature of these sentences, I mean, you really are taking discretion away from judges. Now, I will say, I mean, the reason that you end up with these mandatory sentencing laws is that some judges are, you know, they abuse their discretion and they're you know, letting people out or giving people lighter sentences than really they should be probably. So I think, you know, if judges were a little bit more thoughtful in some cases, they wouldn't be stuck with these mandatory minimums. So yeah, the mandatory sentencing stuff has been an issue for years in the law, and it will continue to be because it's an easy way for lawmakers to look tough on something and to not be terribly thoughtful about it.
An interesting thing is there's one national group, Coalition for Public Safety, that's working on this that involves some pretty conservative groups like Americans for Tax Reform, Freedom Works, Koch Industries, as well as unlikely allies like the ACLU that are working on realizing that we're spending so much, we're locking up too many people. So it's not a partisan thing like you might think.
Well, and it's not every day we have someone who actually is a psychologist that works in drug treatment on a regular basis. So just a reminder, this is Rick's daughter, Sarah Jarvis. I'm going to recruit you in if you could, please. And talk to us a little bit about, when you hear drug dealer, I think of, you know, someone who is dealing drugs every day to lots of people, making lots of money. And I have no sympathy for that person at all, frankly. I just can't. Are all people who are convicted of drug dealing, are they all like that, or are some just the occasional dealers?
I mean, I think it depends in situations, but the vast majority of those that you see that actually get incarcerated are not the big dogs. They're not the ones who are really slinging the drugs that are there on the streets. Most of the time, whenever somebody comes into treatment where I work at, they've not been a drug dealer. They may have traded some drugs. They may have done a few things here and there. They know drug dealers, but still they're not the ones that are in jail. So
if not like big penalties, mm-hmm. if not the fear of jail time, if that doesn't really work as a deterrent, what will? Lori talks about this a lot, about the need to prevent this from happening, because mm-hmm. once you're addicted to this stuff, it's tough to get off. Mm-hmm. So what works?
Well, I think that we have to kind of look at this from a very social perspective. The National Institute of Health defines addiction as being a biopsychosocial medical condition, that we have this biological predisposition to addiction. We see that a whole lot whenever it comes in alcohol. But a lot of these people that are now addicted to substances grew up in homes where substances were heavily used. Most common, it was introduced to them by a parent, by an uncle, by someone within their community or within their home. And so I think that we really got to start targeting people, kind of like, and my dad may strike me for this, but kind of like how the Reagan administration did whenever they had the Say No to Drugs campaign. I mean, I was a child of the 80s. I remember having the T-shirts and everything else. But after that point in time, and I know that program wasn't terribly effective.
Well,
but
I don't know if I'd say that. The DARE program wasn't mm-hmm. terribly effective, but the idea that a whole society is saying
no,
this is a bad idea. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wonder, too, if some of it is people in the community seeing addicts mm-hmm. and seeing how horrible their lives are and just learning directly that mm-hmm. this is not the direction I want to go in. Maybe that's what it'll
right.
take.
Well, I think, and one thing, this is what I say even when working with patients, is that I don't recall anybody ever volunteering to become addicted to heroin. Like, I don't think that there is a single person that says, you know what, whenever I grow up, I think it would be really cool to, you know, snort oxys.
It's not necessarily deterring anybody mm-mm. that, oh, someday I might not be able to get a driver's license if I take drugs, or someday I might have a felony record and have a hard time getting a job. People who are addicted, they're not thinking like that.
No, what you have to kind of consider is the biology of addiction when it comes to that, because and I'm maybe talking too much science with this, but the frontal lobe, which is responsible for all of our kind of decision making and impulse control, that's incredibly sensitive to the substances that people are using. And then there's the behavioral aspect where you learn that this makes things go away, or that I can stick my head in the sand. And so it kind of becomes this then like learned association with things, and people just get stuck within this cycle. And so it's not so much, you know, an active choice, I don't believe, on someone's part. I think it is defined as a habit. It's something that you do unconsciously, and then you have this biological drive to do it through going through withdrawal. So it has that negative reinforcement cycle with it as well.
Rick, you might not get the microphone back. I don't know.
Yeah, might not.
Can you do Bible verses too?
Not as eloquently as him.
Okay. Lori, I'll give you a last bite of the apple if you want it. Is there anything else you want to say on this?
I just wanted to add, too, that a lot of private companies have, in the past couple of years, voluntarily said, we're not going to let a criminal record be automatically disqualifying. If I'm not mistaken, Rick, you might know that there were some big companies that did it.
Well, yeah, you're right. Some major ones did, although off the top of my head, I don't recall which ones.
And I think you're right about the Coke industries too. I think they have, the Koch brothers are very good on criminal justice reform, and I think they've led that effort, you know, not only to work on the laws, but to just to get the private sector voluntarily to, you know, I do think it should be generally up to the companies because they know best, you know, what their requirements are and, you know, how far they can go with it.
Yeah, I guess that's the debate is whether or not, if I can channel House Leader Tim Armstead, I think his point would be that it should be up to the companies to decide whether this matters or not when they make hiring and firing decisions. All right, Rick, what's your Bible verse for today?
Oh, that's a good one.
Oh, you're.
I'm almost
listeners.
So many topics.
Listeners, I wish you had. Right. I wish you had a picture of this because he is coming up with it on the fly.
What do you think? Blessed are the merciful, for they shall attain mercy. That's related to the second chance things. That's Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. You don't think I need a Bible with me to do this, do you?
I thought you had to think about it in advance and plan a little bit. And no, you're just pulling these out of the air. That's impressive.
Yeah.
Do you have that same skill as his daughter?
Again, not quite as eloquent. You know, I use a lot of mantras just in my basic speech on things. And so, no, I'm not as good as him.
All right. I won't let you get out of here without one embarrassing story about Rick Wilson, the father.
I think one thing that is definitely true about his parenting style is that he always tries to put us up to doing odd and random things, and particularly public places. Especially as young children. And, you know, believing our father and seeing him as being a moral and, you know, right guy, we would just do it sometimes without question. So whether that would be like walking through a mall behind him quacking like a duck, or as recently as today, he told me, "Hey, Sarah, walk up to this guy and say this to him." Me having no idea what this means or who this guy is.
What was it?
I think that it has something to do with right to work and profanity. So,
actually, you earn income tax credit in profanity.
but that tradition still continues today. So whether I was 3 and walking behind him quacking like a duck at a mall, or, you know, 33 and being like, "Hey, go do this," it's still occurring to this day. So apparently, I haven't learned anything either.
Well, Rick, thank you for bringing your daughter in here and sharing.
And
Lori, from an undisclosed location, i.e. your house, and the Magic Radio, you're here today. Thanks for being willing to do this while you're juggling a baby.
Well, I literally am holding the baby as I speak. He's fortunately stayed mostly asleep, but if you hear any murmurs in the recording, that's the 6-week-old.
So mine, the one beside me, screamed for the first 6 months of life. She had colic the whole time, so, you know, wishing you better sailing.
And that's the front porch for this week. I'm joined by Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee.
Thanks, Scott.
And his daughter, Sarah Jarvis. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
And Lori Lynn, a Charleston lawyer and columnist and new mother. So thanks for joining us again, Lori. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
Take care. See you next week. Support for The Front Porch comes from WVCarFinder.com, matching West Virginia cars to West Virginians who want to buy them. It's a service of the Charleston Gazette-Mail. More at WVCarFinder.com.